The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. It's going to be another challenging week for a books-loving arts graduate like me. We're talking science and identity, science fiction, and the effects of our current technological revolution on these ancient tools. Our ageing producer tells me he misses the days of writing at full pelt in a noisy newsroom, cigarette hanging from one corner of the mouth and expletives cannoning around the desk. Talking of which, can any of you identify the following quote?
Love, patriotism, zeal for justice and personal spite flamed within him as he sat at his typewriter and began his message. One finger was not enough. He used both hands. The keys rose together like bristles on a porcupine, jammed and were extricated. Curious anagrams appeared on the paper before him. Vulgar fractions and marks of punctuation mingled with the letters. Still, he typed.
And we'll be giving you the answer to that at the end of the podcast. And there is one clue. It does indeed involve hacks and journalism. Now, do you remember as a child trying to work out your whole address from your garden gate to infinity and beyond? Well, Tim Radford's goes something like this. 41 Erewhon Crescent, Hastings, East Sussex, England, Great Britain, Europe, the Northern Hemisphere, planet Earth, the solar system, the Milky Way, the universe. We know this because it's written on the front of his new book, The Address Book, which is all about personal identity. Now, Tim, just let's clear up one thing. You can't tell us that you live in a place called Erewhon Crescent.
I can't. I'm afraid it's an in-joke that only a New Zealander would understand. Erewhon was a place invented by Samuel Butler, who was of a generation of authors I'm unusually fond of. He went out to New Zealand and actually composed Erewhon, which is, of course, nowhere backwards. And I've always had this strange sense that I was rootless but happy, secure wherever I was, anchored, you might say.
So even in Hastings, you're rootless in Hastings. There's the title of your next book. I'm going to stop you there now, because with you in the studio here to talk about your book and indeed his is Peter Forbes, who, by pleasing coincidence, has just won the very lucrative Warwick Prize with a book which looks at strategies for concealing identity. It's called Dazzled and Deceived, Mimicry and Camouflage. And here to talk about it is Richard Lee.
Yes, I've been enjoying it hugely. It's a fascinating account of how the dance of disguises, with animals hiding from predators or copying each other's appearance to avoid getting eaten, sheds a powerful light on the story of evolution, as well as an examination of how artists and scientists found themselves working alongside each other and the military in the First and Second World Wars to camouflage tanks and so on. But Peter, why mimicry? Why is the study of animals mimicking each other so important for the study of evolution?
One of the problems with evolution is that you see what has evolved, but you can't play the counterfactual, what might have evolved. And people complain about just-so stories in evolution, trying to explain after they act why the giraffe has got the long neck, etc., etc. The point about mimicry is that one creature has copied another. There is a model. So you can actually see what the goal was in
evolution. You can tell which way round it was. You can see which was first and which tried to copy.
You can. And, of course, modern genetics has helped us to be sure which was first. I mean, biologists have always pretty well known this. But you can actually see now, you can date genes. So we can be pretty sure which was the model and which was the mimic.
And so this is a kind of evolutionary case study where you can actually see what's going on and how good it has to be and when it happens.
Absolutely. And it all began when Henry Walter Bates was in the Amazon in the 1840s. He not only discovered mimicking butterflies, but he discovered that if he moved through the jungle, as he did, say, 150 miles, that the model in that location would have actually changed its pattern, and the mimics changed as well. Wherever they went, they kept following each other, this sort of strange dance of mimicry.
Isn't there a danger, though, that your mimicry that you're seeing is something that can only be in the eye of the beholder? I'm thinking of the story of Thea, who started suggesting that everything was mimicking everything else. There's even that picture in your book of the peacock who he's drawn against a woodland background as if it's kind of the display of the peacock's feathers is a sense of disguise for it.
Well, in fact, Thayer was, he didn't believe in mimicry at all. He believed in camouflage. But I mean, they're two sides of a coin. But there is this danger. There are some patterns in nature that are just there. I mean, what's the little white comma on a comma butterfly's wing? What's it doing? It's not a comma. There are actually some bits of script, like Arabic script, apparently, on butterflies. These are accidents, you know. And if you're obsessed with a subject, you may see it too often. It isn't always there.
What are the problems with assessing evolution, or convincing people of evolution, maybe, is the huge timescales it works on. It's something that happens over millions and millions of years, and that's very different to our kind of human experience. Do you think that Darwin's combination, which he had, of this geological knowledge and also this Christian respect for outside forces, for how mankind is small in the face of the divine or the omnipotent, do you think that put him in a very special position in terms of being able to appreciate these massive timescales and the processes that operate on them?
Yeah. I think most people find it very, very hard to understand the timescale. And I mean, this is one of the themes of Tim's book as well, that we're not interested in anything beyond two generations before, like grandparents, and two generations afterwards. People are always saying, what's happened to the world? I worry about my grandchildren. People cannot grasp. But Darwin was amazing. He was so prescient because there was very little data then, and he was right about most things, not always about the mechanism, because people didn't even know about genes then. But Darwin had that kind of sensibility. He always said he wasn't actually very bright. He wasn't that kind of mathematical type of genius, but he was exceptionally wise and prescient.
One of the things in your book that we see is that we see the same thing happening on vastly different scales again and again. So like when you're describing sitting in your study and about the impermanence of the house around you, but how the house has been designed to shelter you, in the same way you describe the earth has been designed for us to shelter. Is this a metaphor that you're using, or is it something that comes through in the science, Tim?
It started off as a joke, I'm afraid. I actually thought about the earth as a piece of a state agent's property and thought to myself, well, it's got underfloor central heating and it's fully air-conditioned, it's got hot and cold running water, and yet it was thrown together. I am very interested in the fact that nothing is certain, nothing is permanent. I think we're surrounded by change. We change. One is always reminded of this just at every point. The calamity of the Indian Ocean tsunami, for instance, was the worst natural disaster Sweden has ever experienced. Mm. That's a measure of the distribution of people around the world. We are remarkably connected with each other, and we are all remarkably mobile. None of my neighbours in Hastings, I found out, this is a casual, entirely unsystematic discovery. I just happen to know them all. Absolutely none of them came from Hastings.
So, you mean a collection of Hastings dwellers like that wouldn't have been found a couple of generations ago?
We can't be sure at that either, because if you start looking back in history and ask yourself, were people settled and static in the Roman Empire? The answer is God, no. One is reminded that Constantine proclaimed himself emperor in York and then went on to found a city on the shores of the Bosphorus. So we have a shifting world. And, of course, if you just think about physics, what the lessons we have of physics. So we're all sitting here completely almost motionless in the studio, but of course we're travelling at least 600 miles an hour towards the night and then the dawn. The Earth on which we're sitting is actually whizzing through space at 20 kilometres a second, and the Sun is going around the galaxy at 200 kilometres a second. And at this point, of course, it's not possible to register speeds like this. So my book was an attempt to try and make sense of these things. And it was very rewarding to write, as indeed Peter's book must have been very rewarding for him, because there is a limit to what you can do in a book. And books are a very interesting little artifact. To work well, it only has to choose one thread of a story. It can't try and put too much in. So lots of science books leave you a little blank about the rest of the world. If you were reading, for instance, about Einstein and Max Born and Max Planck and the discovery of physics, you wouldn't ever have any reason to know that Franz Lehár was writing The Merry Widow at the same time and James Joyce was playing with Bloomsday. There is a lack of connection with the world outside it. And Peter's book, in this sense, is fabulous, because not only does it explain evolution by taking one tiny thread of the whole messy picture of evolution and illuminating it, But it actually then proceeds, because it's dealing with mimicry and camouflage, it proceeds through the whole history of the 20th century. You could actually write a sketch of 20th century history. You couldn't say who were the good guys, but you could write a sketch of 20th century history just by following that story.
One of the things that's, again, fascinating from it is it reveals how scientists are very much part of their time, and they see the world through the lens of the things that they experience around them. I'm thinking of Hewitson, who rejected the idea that the Papilio merope butterfly could indulge with a harem of females because it just shocked him too much.
Yes, I mean, it was just so Victorian. I mean, the scientific papers then about the butterflies, they talked about butterfly mating in terms of wooing and coyness. I mean, this was a sort of Victorian language. Also, all the stories about the squabbles between artists and naturalists about who was best to advise on camouflage in the war, Sayer's crazy quest to prove that everything was camouflaged. You know, he tried to convince the military authorities that you had to dress up your ships in very complicated ways. And in fact, Sayer had this huge squabble with Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt was a big game hunter and he knew his animals. And they engaged in huge spats in public, in books and articles. Sayer was a visionary. He was a strange man. Roosevelt was a tough guy, you know. He said, I shoot these animals out on the plains of Africa. Most of these creatures aren't camouflaged, you know. you can see them a mile away. Yeah. So all of these crazy stories that got bound up, I started out with the one track, evolution mimicry, but so much came out along the way.
I'm interested in how it tricks the eye. You're breaking outlines, are you? I mean, if you're talking about military camouflage or fashion, you know, that sort of, those fashion jackets that everybody wears.
Well, there's two basic ideas. You're talking about this disruptive coloration that breaks up outlines. So, I mean, the idea is, I mean, the zebra is a problem. We still don't understand the zebra. The idea of the zebra is obviously it's very loud colours. It's op art. The idea is that the jangle breaks up the pattern. The other kind of camouflage, where it mimics the surroundings. So if you've got a moth that actually has the markings very much like the bark of the tree, then it does melt into the background, disappears. But you can't do that with big creatures. Most mimicking creatures, most camouflage creatures are insects. They're tiny. Big creatures can't really hide like that. But what you can do with a big animal or with a tank is you paint patterns over it that obscure the fact that you can see something, but you can't see that it's a zebra, or you can't see that it's a tank. That's the idea.
Or you can't see what kind of tank it is.
See what kind of tank it is. In warfare, it's important to actually, you know, not. You can see that there's something there. Well, ships, for instance, it very much matters what kind of ship it is that's on the horizon. Obviously, if you think it's harmless and it's actually a battleship, you're in trouble.
Well, just as the scientists are creatures of their own time, again, the artists who came into the military to try and disguise these massive things were also part of their own time. So you had cubist camouflage in the First World War, and then something slightly different in the Second.
Cubism emerged about just after, 1908, I guess, was when Picasso and Braque got going. So there was 6 years between then and the war. So a lot of artists had absorbed Cubism by then. The French were the first camouflage corps in World War One, and some of the artists were Cubists. So when Picasso saw his first, he wasn't involved, obviously, but he was walking in Paris with Gertrude Stein in 1915, or was it late 14? They saw a tank, and Picasso said, yeah, we made that. That is Cubism. And of course, strictly, it's true, because Cubism did break up the outline. And strangely enough, when you think of the bright colours of much of painting after Impressionism and Fauvism, Cubism, very muddy colours. They're already camouflaged colours.
So would you say that the artists or the scientists won in terms of who got to decide what to camouflage tanks with?
Well, it's very strange. In World War One, it was mostly the artists who won. There's this guy, Norman Wilkinson, who devised dazzle ships, which is actually painting ships like zebras, and that was adopted by the Navy in large numbers. Unfortunately, the naturalists like Thayer, who actually advocated camouflage in World War One, were so eccentric, they were turned aside. But in World War II, Peter Scott actually was a naval commander who, strangely enough, introduced single-handedly, almost unofficially, Thayer's system of camouflage, and it was adopted. Thayer was long dead by then, so he kind of won round two.
But these days it's all digital camouflage, isn't it? So, I mean, what does this jostling between the artists and the scientists tell us about the relation between the two, Tim?
It's supposed to be a bad relationship. I've never thought that way at all. I think it's a dichotomy that the English are very fond of, but nobody else in the world cares about it at all. I did actually once try to talk to Primo Levi about the two cultures, and he looked at me as though I was mad and just pointed out that Dante was actually a member of the Florentine Society of Apothecaries and would have considered himself a scientist. So there, he said. I really think that Peter's book is about how we see the world. My book is about how we see the world. Darwin's book is about how we see the world. And if Picasso had written the kind of successful work that one would hope from him, that too would have been about how we see the world around us.
The successful books are books which combine arts and science, but I mean, are there dangers in that? Which side of the divide would you place yourself on, or like Tim, would you reject it?
Well, I reject it. I like Tim, love Primo Levi, and Primo was one of these people. And there's an Italian culture, actually, of one culture, science and art. It is our dichotomy. It's no Levis. I mean, it's very much bound up in English society. But I started as a chemist, and I worked in poetry as a poetry editor for a long time. Tim has been both literary and science editor. We both feel ourselves to be one culture men. Obviously, it's hard in this world with information overload to keep up with everything. Sometimes I'm more into art, sometimes more into science, but I try to keep them both going. I didn't think there are any dangers.
I think that there are dangers. Because surely if you're trying to cover such a big waterfront, you are liable to make errors, aren't you? I'm going to show off now and cite my reading of Nick Lane's Life Ascending, which won the Royal Society Prize last year. I happen to know a bit about botany, and I happen to know that the point about dandelions is that they're asexual in one part of the world and sexual in another. And Nick keeps making this joke about how dandelions don't have any sex life. Now, it's an easy joke. It is incorrect. He is outside his expertise. He might be very knowledgeable in his area. He doesn't know about dandelions.
Well, we're all terrified of making mistakes. And, I mean, even experts can make mistakes in their own subject. I just think you have to be brave enough to try to go out and do it.
How do you prevent yourself from making mistakes? Because you must be reaching outside your own expertise, both of you.
Mm. A lifetime of reaching out of my own expertise. In the case of journalism, of course, it's dead simple. You use ignorance as a constructive tool. It is a spanner with which to open a safe. You know what you don't know, so you ask the questions, and you hope that the guy who's talking to you is telling you either the truth or what he thinks is the truth.
Is your book a journalist's book, would you say?
I'm not going to pretend to be anything other than a journalist, but I didn't want it to be overtly a journalist's book in which I went out with a pencil and a notebook and puffed up a hill talking to an expert who would then tell me what the Maya thought about the world around them. I found that I was actually drawing on things I already knew. Occasionally I would look up something, but most of the time it was things that I had read so often, seen so often, talked to people about so often, that I had absorbed it, and it seemed to come out fresh.
Whereas, Peter, was your book rather more of a voyage of discovery for you?
It was, as I say. I most of the stories I simply didn't know when I started. But, I mean, it is a worry. I love research. I mean, I love research probably more than writing. When I had to do the World War II, the archives at Kew, it was astonishing. You know, these files, some of them were written in the Western Desert at the time of El Alamein. I mean, they sort of, you know, they still survive, but they're falling to pieces. So that was a huge thrill. Well, you know, you interrogate the sources and you cross-check them and you ask the experts and you hope for the best.
But is it all the more important to research and to get important pieces of new science out to popular readers in a world where 43% of Americans don't believe in evolution? Does it depress you to still have to make arguments that are convincing for natural selection?
Well, it does worry me that, but I can see how evolution, like much of science, seems counterintuitive to many people. I mean, many people are Lamarckist if they believe in evolution. They think that, you know, what you do in your life somehow must get passed on. And that's one of the first problems with evolution. No, it doesn't work like that. It's indirect, and people cannot really grasp that. I can see evolution is a tough problem. It is depressing that we seem to have gone backwards. I think in the 50s, a better ratio than 43% of the American population would have accepted evolution. We're going backwards in some respects.
Again, as your book reveals, this is an impermanent world, a world where process is important. So, again, one of the problems with evolution is that it's not a thing, but a process.
Yes, it is. It's difficult to explain. Most of it can't be explained. But poor, Nick Lane's book is terrific because it bravely tackles an issue for which there is no evidence whatsoever. In my own book, I actually try and describe the origin of life as a body coming to life in a locked library, opening it, escaping, throwing away the key, burning the library down, and then trampling over the ground around it for 3.8 billion years just to obliterate any evidence whatsoever. So we have the world that exists now, and we have to try and read it backwards and reconstruct the story so far on very fragile scraps of evidence. And the answer is, are we frightened of being wrong? Well, of course we're going to be wrong. The whole point about science is that it's either overturned or overtaken. There is no stable science. Science itself is a process of discovery.
And I think that's actually probably a very good place to leave it. I hope you, neither of you, will be overtaken or overturned too soon. Thanks, Peter and Tim, for coming in. Tim Radford's The Address Book is published by Fourth Estate, and Peter Forbes' Dazzled and Deceived, Mimicry and Camouflaged is published by Yale. Ah, there's a sound you don't hear these days in the modern corporate office surroundings. And it has indeed just been reported that the world's last typewriter factory in India is about to close. It's said that the old machines can no longer compete with computers, even though they themselves have long gone electronic. There's an immediate chorus from would-be suppliers in the US that they can still get you one if that's what you really, really want. But we on the Guardian Books Desk felt a twinge of sadness. So to cheer ourselves up, we started our own thread on Twitter asking you for your favourite literary quotations about the old clacking machines.
There is nothing to writing. All you do is sit down at a typewriter and bleed. Ernest Hemingway.
The writing ball is a thing like me, made of iron, yet easily twisted on journeys. Patience and tact are required in abundance, as well as fine fingers to use us. Nietzsche.
The early typewriter was full of caprices. It had as many immoralities as the machine of today has virtues. Mark Twain.
I thought you were supposed to be good, the typewriter said, with the voice of a teenage gunslinger. From Misery by Stephen King.
She had started another novel and would type noisily through all the programs. So I made her move it back into the sitting room. Then she came and typed in the sitting room because she said the noise of the machine helped her to concentrate. Margaret Drabble.
Put this typewriter in the Volvo, drive to the nearest politician and hurl through his front window. Hunter S. Thompson.
My two fingers on a typewriter have never connected with my brain. Graham Greene.
I just sit at a typewriter and curse a bit. P.G. Woodhouse.
Throw up into your typewriter every morning. Clean up every noon. Raymond Chandler.
And thanks for those to James Purden, the James Hughes, Historian Laura, Ian underscore Ellison, Prof. Alok Kumar, Duncan Jeffries and Leisha Hurd. And if you don't believe that the typewriter is definitely on its way out, it's also been reported this week that the Greenwich Village Writers' Room in New York City has now banned typewriters in favour of laptops, after years of telling users that, as the sign used to say,
in the event that there are no desks available, laptop users must make room for typists.
Ah. Those were the days. But we can't stay nostalgic for long with so much to look forward to over the coming week in The Guardian and The Observer. Richard, before we run through the highlights, will you please tell us where that infuriating typewriter quote at the beginning came from?
Yes, our hapless reporter was, of course, William Boot in Evelyn Waugh's Scoop.
So there we go. Now let's take a turn to the future. Richard, there's some sterling stuff to look forward to in our papers and on our website in the coming week.
On Saturday, The Guardian Review is heading off into space with a science fiction special, celebrating an exciting new exhibition at the British Library. It will include transcripts of interviews from some lost masters of the genre.
Isaac Asimov.
You can't tell what an individual molecule is going to do, but if you deal with trillions and quadrillions and quintillions, you can tell very accurately what they're going to do in the average. And I thought maybe you could do that with human beings too. You could tell what huge masses of human beings would do, provided they didn't know what the predictions were, so they couldn't distort their own behavior, and provided you had a large enough number. And I felt with the Galactic Empire, you'd have a large enough number.
Arthur C. Clarke.
This was the paper which started the Comsat business. I wrote it early in 1945, and it was published in Wireless World in October, in fact, just after the war had ended. And it laid down the principles which now determine the world's communication system, the idea that you'd have satellites poised at such a height above the Earth that they remained stationary in the sky, the so-called synchronous or geostationary orbit. A few people got excited about it. I know the Americans did first, and I have reason to believe that this is one of the stimuli which started the American satellite program off.
Kurt Vonnegut Jr.
We have the mainstream, and this is some little backwater. But science fiction writers customarily have written very fast and have not cared much about literary niceties, have not usually spent much time on drawing characters. And so you have to be lucky. You have to be intuitive. You simply have to be lucky. And in order to be lucky, you need a lot of time, and most people don't have it, so that's why it's so tough to be a story writer at night or on weekends. You need the continuous concentration. So I don't know why I did it, but it seemed like a good idea, and I've tried all kinds of things which the world has never seen, which this is not a good idea, and threw it in a wastebasket.
J.G. Ballard.
As I wrote Empire of the Sun, I could see the way in which the landscapes of Shanghai had permeated all my previous novels in disguised form. But I realise now that I probably was writing about them all the time, and that one of the reasons I chose to write science fiction at the beginning was that it offered me a way in which I could remake the landscapes of the England I knew in the 1960s and 1970s in the way that the surrealists were, to make them resemble, sort of unconsciously, the landscapes of wartime Shanghai. I could flood London and the drowned world. I could reshape the everyday reality of Britain, Western Europe, and the United States.
We'll have lots of writers nominating their favourite science fiction classics, and we're hoping our listeners and readers will get involved in that as well.
Yes, we'll be collecting recommendations for a podcast in a fortnight's time. You'll be able to nominate your favourites on Monday on guardian.co.uk/books.
And so, farewell. We're still urging you to join our subscriber list. And if you came to us from iTunes, why not join in some of our conversations on our website? It has a sparkling new user-friendly design and is all about you, the readers. Again, go to guardian.co.uk/books. I look forward to chatting to you all there. But until we meet again, my thanks to Tim Radford, Peter Forbes, Richard Lee, and our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.